You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Jarrett Adams spent nearly a decade in prison here in Wisconsin after a wrongful conviction for sexual assault. After getting his conviction overturned, his record expunged, he became an attorney himself, working with others who are wrongfully behind bars and with people who have long sentences for minor offenses. He shares his story in his new book, a firsthand account of some of the injustices in our criminal justice and prison systems and how he's trying to make them right. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or someone you know spent time in the criminal justice system? How did it impact life after getting out? What barriers to reentry did you encounter? Do you have questions for our guest about his experience and the justice system here in Wisconsin, which has the worst racial disparity for imprisonment in the entire country? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jarrett Adams is an attorney and the author of the new book, Redeeming Justice, From Defendant to Defender, My Fight for Equity on Both Sides of a Broken System. Jarrett, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thank you for having me. I appreciate being back on.
Well, you've shared your story with us in the past. I want to focus in on a particular moment here. You write in your introduction, quoting, "In this country, we have two criminal justice systems, the one you can afford and the one you can't." Can you talk about how that system let you down? It worked differently for you and one of your then friends who was charged but was able to afford an attorney. Can you talk about that double system?
Yeah, it's a double system for sure. I mean, and you don't have to just take my words for it. You can look at the numbers and they glaringly show it. In my case in particular, there were three of us accused of the sexual assault. Only one of my friends was able to afford an attorney. Me and my other co-defendant, you know, we were assigned an attorney off of a panel list. And that directly impacted my case so much so that the retained attorney for my friend was filing motion after motion after motion. My attorney and my other co-defendant's panelist attorney as well never joined in his motion. They never gave us the opportunity to. They made the decision to proceed forward to trial. And it was the fork in the road that took almost a decade of both of our lives.
And that's one of the most frustrating parts of your story to read, the interactions you had with lawyers during your trial. Can you talk about how that system let you down? And you write, it's not just that it's the lawyers themselves. Those public defenders are often overwhelmed with many cases.
They definitely are. And in particular, in my case, we didn't get public defenders. You know, the public defender's office was conflicted out. So we were assigned attorneys off of a panel list in the state of Wisconsin and in other states as well. There's a panel list of attorneys who are assigned cases by the court. And the problem with that is this. First of all, the amount of pay is so low that you don't get the best representation. Not many attorneys are going to go do cases for $50 an hour or $70 an hour. And so that was, you know, a big issue in my case as well. And then, you know, it's one of these things, Rob, where you're on an island and you are facing the might of the entire system. They're not playing when they say state versus whoever it is. And it was just glaring. No investigator was hired in my case. And I thought it was just me. When I got to prison, and when I started to meet other men and helping them with their cases and learn about their cases, I saw this across the board.
You spent time almost 10 years in Wisconsin's prison system, and you write that for people there wrongly or who are guilty, you don't see the prison system doing a lot of good to turn them around. What were some of the biggest flaws, the problems you saw in Wisconsin prisons?
You know, it's just, first of all, there's overcrowding. It's way too many people who are in prison, and they are in prison as a result of these old draconian sentences and in the ways in which we feel like lock them up, throw away the key forever. And so, you know, you're in this prison, and these mandatory sentences, they are the seed for hopelessness. If people know that they're going to be in prison, no matter how good they are, no matter how much they change and how much they reform, if they know they're going to be in prison for two decades, there's no incentive for them to do anything positive at all. So that was one of the biggest things. Another thing is this, Rob, there's no correcting at all going on. You're being warehoused in this prison. And you're pretty much just getting up, going to sleep, getting up, going to sleep. There has to be an investment in the people that are there. inmates are people as well. And you just don't see the educational, tools being handed out. Most people who are incarcerated will go home at some point. And we are doing a horrible job of preparing people to reintegrate back into society.
Talking to Jarrett Adams, attorney, author of the new book, Redeeming Justice, From Defendant to Defender, My Fight for Equity on Both Sides of a Broken System. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Jarrett, something I hadn't known until I read your book. You ended up in Boscobel, once called the Supermax Prison in Wisconsin, billed as being this site for the worst of the worst in the prison system. How did you end up there?
So you know that old saying in baseball, if you build it, they will come? That's exactly what Boscobel was. There was this rush to build this sparkling brand new facility for the worst of the worst. And it was one of these things where they took the Jeffrey Dahmer murder and they used that to scare people into getting the funding to build this prison. And when they built it, there was no worst of the worst like that. There was only a handful of people who you could say even, deserved and met the criteria to be there. So what they did was this. They started to, like almost like a quota ticket system, they started to create allegations of confidential informants and putting people in segregation for 360 days at a time. And they swept me up in one of those. And they did this in large part because I continued to litigate against the Department of Corrections, their handbook, and some of the things that we weren't getting access to education-wise in there. So it's just, it was one of these things where you had this message going out that it was necessary, that it was needed. But then you saw people going there for, they broke off the front of their razor to get a close shave, or, this person had food in his cell. And it just was ridiculous. And I don't think anyone really looked under the hood until, they had so many people packed and the litigation finally opened up Boscobel to a normal prison that it is now.
Okay, Jarrett, you spend almost, again, 10 years. You've been working on your case the whole time. The Innocence Project helps out. Finally, you get the conviction overturned. Your record was expunged. If you had said, I'm going to stay as far away from prisons and the legal system as I possibly can, I would get it. You went the opposite direction. What made you decide to become a lawyer and work to prevent this from happening to other people?
There are certain things that I will never forget, being in prison for so long. And one of the things isn't an act of violence. It was looking at the creases of pain and anguish on my mother's face. I'll never forget seeing that. And I also acknowledge this. Look, this started because I told my parents I was going to spend the night over a friend's house. My friends told their parents they were spending the night over my house. So we snuck to Wisconsin to go to this party. And it just was the worst fears realized. I now know why my mother was creative and keeping me busy in the summer. And, all type of things that African-American parents have to do to keep their kids out of trouble. And so when I came home, I knew I had a penchant for the law, and it became a passion, and I was driven to remove the wrinkles and creases of anguish off of other mothers' faces as well.
You had vowed you wouldn't come back to Wisconsin unless you did it as an attorney. Can you share this moment, you share it in the book, at the state capitol, I think it was, when you were sworn into the Wisconsin bar?
I was sworn into the Wisconsin bar by Keith Finley. So it was
of the Innocence Project.
Yeah, of the Innocence Project. And so it was really, really a dream type moment, to hear him, swear me in, motion that I get in and I be accepted and acknowledged by all of the justices. And I'll make this point too, Rob. If the justices, if the courts could see me as I am now, when I was a 17-year-old, I never would have been sentenced to 28 years in prison. And so I think it's a point that I want to emphasize on. And I enjoyed the moment and it inspired me to keep going to create other Jarrett Adams.
We're talking to Jarrett Adams, attorney, author of the new book, Redeeming Justice, From Defendant to Defender, My Fight for Equity on Both Sides of a Broken System. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced the criminal justice system on either side as someone accused of a crime, somebody defending that person, somebody prosecuting it? Have you seen somebody in your family go through this experience? Have you yourself? What could we do better, do you think, here in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions for our guest. It's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Jarrett Adams about his new book, Redeeming Justice, From Defendant to Defender, My Fight for Equity on Both Sides of a Broken System. Now an attorney, he was wrongfully convicted, spent almost 10 years in jail, or in prison, I should say, before the conviction was overturned, his record expunged. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Alicia is with us in Portage. Alicia, hi. Alicia, are you there? Nope. Let's go to Vivian then in Green Bay. Vivian, hello.
Hello. I am a product of a very rural Wisconsin community. I'm in my 70s and watching exposés, going back to the New York Five, to so many things through the Innocence Project, I think justice system is a misnomer. And when anyone refers to it that way, I say we don't have a justice system, we have a judicial system, and I've never had any encounters in that system, but I don't see it as a justice system.
Vivian, thanks a lot for the call. Jarrett, what do you think of Vivian's distinction?
I agree, and it's, you know, it's encouraging, you know, to have, you know, someone in Green Bay in their 70s who's been around a while and seen a lot in life, you know, to acknowledge that. And now we just need the officials, the lawmakers, to acknowledge it as well. We have a system that pounds people, especially people of color. One in every 36 Black Wisconsin adults is incarcerated in a state prison in Wisconsin. I mean, that number should make everyone drop what they're doing and turn their attention to fixing this system.
Thanks for that call, Vivian, at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Pierre in La Crosse. Pierre, hi.
Yeah, I am calling because the justice system, there is a white justice system and there is a Black justice system. What you can't even say called justice system, because I have a family member that was charged with a crime. They charged with the highest crime. In order for them to just try to negotiate it to a lower crime, where they should have charged them that at, in the first place. And in the same person, they were charged high with a felony. And I know another person that did almost the same crime. They got charged with two different felony, but that person with the two different felony end up having no probation, nothing to do because they were white. And that other family member ended up having to be on probation for a year and paying a whole bunch of fines that he cannot even afford.
Pierre, thanks for the call. Is this a common story, you think, Jarrett? Two different systems, Pierre says, depending on race.
Absolutely. I mean, and I think people should, you know, just look at the numbers. You know, look at the recent article that came out. You know, in Wisconsin, 42% of the state prison population in 2019 was African Americans. I mean, just think about that. Think about the number of residents in the population in Milwaukee, which is the biggest jurisdiction where the African-American population is. I mean, if you think about the men that we have incarcerated and you think about the issues that exist within the inner cities, you're taking away a proponent that could fix, that can change, that can mentor. We're literally throwing away people with this truth in sentencing. And it was ran on the basis of, let's do truth in sentencing. Let's, you know, have all of these sentences where we give this time and they have to complete it because it'll make us safer. Rob, it's not safer. It's not.
Pierre, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. And Pierre's call reminds me, Jarrett, he talked about, you know, being charged with one thing and settling for a lesser offense, something you learned from your personal experience. And then again, as an attorney, is a lot of times people, especially maybe a young person in that situation, it's complicated. Courts are complicated things. They may not be getting good advice when they're making that kind of decision on the spot.
Absolutely. And there's also this, Rob. Look, people make decisions sometimes to get out of the pain that they're in. And I met a number of different men who pled guilty just to get out of the Milwaukee House of Corrections, only to come back and go to prison because they were on parole. And I think that, you know, one of the things that we have to inject in our system is this. We have to get more therapists, social workers, forensic psychologists. We need to allow the world of therapy to mend this system. I mean, I'm talking about both ends, right? I'm talking about both correctional officers. I've seen and have befriended some correctional officers who come in to these jobs, and within, you know, a year or even months, I mean, it's almost like they're an inmate as well. They're feeling the effects of this system, which is telling us something. The system isn't working.
Talking to Jarrett Adams, attorney. He was wrongfully convicted, spent almost 10 years in Wisconsin prisons. His new book is called Redeeming Justice, From Defendant to Defender, My Fight for Equity on Both Sides of a Broken System. Jarrett, wrongfully convicted. You're in prison for so long, 360 days in segregation, as we mentioned, at Bosque Bell. What got you through?
You know, I had a round table of angels, and my mother and my two aunts, and I opened the book up, Redeeming Justice. The first page is a dedication to them. And what they would do is they would write letters in a staggered approach. One would write a letter on Monday, the other on Wednesday, the other on Friday. And they would write these letters, and they would, you know, have Bible verses inside of them. And, you know, I asked my aunt, you know, because she would give me like the newspaper subscription. I would get it late. And I asked her, I said, why do you, you know, send this paper still, and you guys write these letters? I hear from you guys enough. I'll talk. And she says, no, listen, there's a reason why we're doing it. And the reason why we're doing it is this. We've acknowledged that they've confined your body, that you can never let them incarcerate your mind. And that was one of the things that kept me getting through. You know, when I came home and I was on a race pace to get this law degree. And I remember my boss at the time, I was working at the Federal Defender. You know, she was just like, you know, look, you got to take a break. Like, what are you, you know, moving so fast for? And the real reality, Rob, was this. That decade wasn't just stolen from me. It was stolen from my family as well. I was cookouts, fish fries before I went to prison. I come home, there's dialysis treatments, there are visits in old folks' home. So I was racing because I wanted my aunts to see me get this law degree. And I was fortunate enough to get that done before my aunt Josephine passed away.
Let's go back to our callers now. Tina is with us in Shawano. Tina, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
Well, I've been a practicing attorney in Wisconsin for almost 34 years now. And I've been a prosecutor a couple times. I've been a defense attorney. I've been a social services attorney. I've been a judge on a few occasions. And, you know, my observation is that our system is not only broken, it's completely corrupt. You know, not only do we treat, you know, people of color, you know, differently, substantially differently, you know, it's really all about money. The courts have to, it's like any other bureaucracy, the courts have to make money. And they charge fines that no one can pay. No one can pay those, even if they have, you know, a decent job, which in Shawano is like $14 an hour. You know, they don't take an effect, you know, how this process affects families. You know, they drag out cases, they overcharge, they over-sentence. I mean, it's completely corrupt. It doesn't work at all. And if we want a system that works, we have to provide more of it. You know, for lack of a better word, in the Native American community, would call it a healing program.
Tina, thanks a lot for sharing your perspective. And Jarrett, that reminds me, part of your work now is on wrongful convictions. You're also worried about what Tina mentioned there, overcharging people for lesser crimes, either longer prison systems, sentences, or as Tina mentioned, unpayable fines.
Absolutely. I mean, Tina was spot on with that. We over-punish and pummel the poor. In our society, I want people to understand there are people in living in the inner city, you know, in Milwaukee, where every dollar and penny is accounted for month to month. And so, you know, a speeding ticket, a red light camera ticket or something like that can throw them off of their entire budget. You know, I also want to point out this. You know, I'm representing a guy right now, Antoine Robbins. You know, he was convicted of an armed robbery along with his co-defendant, who was Caucasian. His co-defendant, you know, received a significantly less sentence and has been home now for quite some time, after only serving about 7 years. Mr. Robinson has been in prison now for the last 20 years on an armed robbery where no one was killed and no one was shot. It makes absolutely no sense why we can't even get a court to consider really using the law of sentence modifications. It's just, we have to overhaul the system, and that overall has to be more than just changing the faucet. We need to rip up the floor and change the pipes.
Jared, just in our last minute, do you see that happening anytime soon, that kind of reform, that kind of overhaul?
Well, it's anything like this on this grand scale is going to take a lot of folks, a lot of time and a lot of resources. And this has to be spearheaded by the law schools as well as the judicial system and the lawyers and prosecutors. Everyone has to have an all hands on deck approach. And I'll use this as an example. We just dealt with the pandemic where for a while, people stopped fighting with each other because we were fighting this deadly virus. And, you know, what we did was come together and figure it out. And then we went back to fighting each other. But the point I'm making is, if we all came together and decided to make change, real change, systematic change, where we got diverse people on the bench and in the prosecutor's office, we would have a much better system and we would have much better communities than we have right now.
Jared, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. You guys have me back anytime.
That's Jared Adams, attorney and author of the new book, Redeeming Justice, From Defendant to Defender, My Fight for Equity on Both Sides of a Broken System. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, it's our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. Tomorrow includes the signing of the long-awaited infrastructure bill, plus some new developments in the ongoing January 6th investigation in the U.S. House. And we'll get some advice on staying safe in Wisconsin during deer hunting season for hunters, hikers, and more. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, an anti-Biden insult is the latest viral political meme. We'll find out how those kind of slogans and memes go viral and what impact, if any, they have on political discourse. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the director of a prominent political poll in the U.S. says he screwed up and maybe we shouldn't do horse race polls anymore during election seasons. Our guest makes the case that the polling crisis is maybe a catastrophe for American democracy. First, an insult directed toward President Biden has become a rallying cry for many conservatives. The phrase, "Let's go, Brandon," went viral when a reporter apparently misheard a vulgar chant about the president from a crowd at a NASCAR race. Now it's all over social media, political rallies, even a rap song that briefly went to number one on the iTunes charts. We're learning more about why these types of slogans and memes take off and what impact, if any, they have on the political landscape. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you encountered this one? Do you follow political memes? Do you share them from one side or another? Are you bothered by the language inferred in this particular message? Or is this a fad that will fade and you're not worried about it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Mike Wagner is a professor in the University of Wisconsin-Madison's School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Mike, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. It's good to be here.
What makes a political meme or slogan, maybe like this one, go viral these days?
If we could predict that, we could make quite a bit of money in the world of politics. It's really hard to know. There's not the work that kind of looks at virality finds that there aren't really necessarily key features that are always good predictors of whether something goes viral. The things that seem to be the best predictors or the most often accurate include things that come with some deal of emotion, often anger. But that's a little bit different than the "Let's go, Brandon" chant, which is a little more tongue-in-cheek, covering up for a more vulgar chant, you know, and that sort of thing. Although it's rooted, I suppose, in anger that those who don't support President Biden might feel about him.
When a catchphrase emerges like this one, and I think you could probably point toward others, some targeting former President Trump, it doesn't seem like anybody's going to hear this and change their mind about a president. It seems like, though, it is a marker, a way for people to share, to express a shared identity. What do you think about that idea?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things that chants like this can do when it comes to how we might better understand our political moment. So one is that it can serve as sort of a way to signal what side you're on and offer those who share your side a safe haven to share views. And so people who are sharing that meme or engaging in that chant, or maybe they wryly say to a neighbor while standing, you know, at the crosswalk, something like that, can signal what side they're on. And so there's a little bit of an opportunity to kind of engage in some solidarity building or group signaling and that sort of thing. But it also can serve to shape how other political observers interpret the contemporary moment, right? We're talking about this on the radio right now, right? So this kind of chant or these kinds of political memes and slogans can also serve to direct conversation away from other things, right? President Biden just signed into law a gigantic legislative bill that, you know, is likely to be even more popular than it is now once some of the elements of the bill start to happen. And so if you're an opponent of the president, you want to divert attention from that. And a slogan like this might be a way to do it.
And I know you put a lot of work into following how people congregate in the social media world, on the media spectrum, and how ideas flow. If we think of a slogan like this as, you know, a dye you put into our you know, those things for when they do X-rays and they put a dye in you, like, how would you try to track how this sort of thing goes and spreads in social media?
So we would want to start with who are the central nodes, who are doing the most spreading and then getting the most engagement. In other words, who's sharing this kind of meme or this hashtag, say, on Twitter, and then who's liking that tweet, who's retweeting it, who's commenting in positive ways on it, and then what are the shape of their networks that these folks are connecting to, and how do these things spread? Are they in a homogeneous network where it's just kind of bouncing around the political right and not really getting much purchase among those who are in the middle or on the left? Or is it something that's crossing ideological lines and being seen by lots of other folks? One thing we would also then look for is how the other side would try to reappropriate the message, right? So for example, during the Obama years, there was a hashtag Thanks Obama that conservatives would use to complain about things they didn't like about President Obama's presidency. Over time, liberals began using Thanks Obama when good things would happen, mm-hmm. you know, so the, you know, unemployment is down, hashtag Thanks Obama, and it becomes kind of an ironic comment on how the meme was originally used. And so one thing we would also want to look for is there a backlash to the meme or the chant or the slogan? And is it being reasserted on the other side as a badge of honor or a point of pride?
And I've seen that is happening. At least one political group is going with a thank you, Brandon, message, much like the thanks,
right.
Obama, and referring in part to the infrastructure bill you just mentioned. So these things become contested. They're footballs. I don't know. Is it just fun and goofy, or is there something real here?
I think those aren't mutually exclusive categories. I think it is a little
fair.
Goofy, you know, but I think there also is something going on, right? It has captured the imagination of some people who cover politics and comment on politics. Some people who work in politics interpret this as a tea leaf reading of what the mood of the country is. I think that's probably overwrought and a little bit overdone, just as we often try to interpret what one election in one state means for what, say, the next congressional set of elections are going to mean, or what the next presidential election is going to look like. I think we can overinterpret some of these things and think that they are a stronger signal than perhaps they really are.
We're talking about political memes, slogans, and catchphrases, how they spread, what they do and don't mean. Mike Wagner is with us from the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Mike, I was reminded of an old political slogan, 140 years ago or so, about Grover Cleveland in a presidential campaign. Ma, ma, where's my pa? Referring to an adultery scandal. And then it got reconfigured and people added, gone to the White House, ha, 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 when he won. How new is this?
Yeah, in some respects, there is nothing new under the sun. We have had slogans since we had people seeking public attention, right? And so from Tippi Canoe and Tyler II and William Henry Harrison's election to Abraham Lincoln's, you know, not wanting to change horses in midstream, when he was running for re-election, to Ulysses S. Grant's slogan related to vote the way you shot. You know, these are all things that have been a part of our country's politics. Happy days are here again with Franklin Roosevelt, or I'm just wild about Harry. Some of these things became songs, right? And so, or were crafted from songs in other cases. And so there's always been a relationship between slogans, music, art, public commentary, and we've seen that stuff really kind of get, you know, supersized in our era. For example, Barack Obama's "Yes We Can" became a slogan, but it also then became an artistic piece and a music video that Will.i.am created, and it gave the Obama campaign all of this extra free attention that was building off of the slogan from a speech he gave after winning the Iowa caucus, you know, in the beginning of the 2008 presidential campaign. So we see these sorts of things all the time, and we see them, you know, that are positive, like "Yes We Can." We see them negative, like "Lock Her Up," which Donald Trump used in his campaign for the White House the first time. And then we see, you know, sillier ones like "Let's Go Brandon," which, you know, is a dig at President Biden without mentioning him by name.
How about messages crafted to frame a policy item? And here I'm thinking of something like death panels, claims of death panels in the Affordable Care Act. They weren't there, but it was a phrase that was tested and spread and may, I think people might still argue this, may have helped turn public opinion against the Affordable Care Act.
There are lots of examples throughout our history of policy debate where the way that issues get framed can influence public support for them. And so the death panels is a good example, or whether we frame a tax on money people might inherit from their parents as a state tax or a death tax, for example, right? Do we think about abortion rights as an issue of life for a fetus or choice for a person who is pregnant? And so we see these sorts of frames dominate some policy discussions. More often than not, news coverage of policy debates focus on who's winning and losing, which makes the framing of the issue and the kinds of ways both sides try to characterize what the issue means important for how the public understands what the stakes are and eventually we would hope what the actual content of the legislation is, although research suggests that we learn a lot more about the content of legislation after the votes are cast and not before.
We're talking about political memes inspired in part by the latest viral phrase among conservatives, "Let's Go Brandon." Digging deeper than that, though, our guest today is UW-Madison journalism professor Mike Wagner. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a problem with people using the phrase "Let's Go Brandon"? Do you pass along yourself harmless fun? What about other political memes? Are they distractions from more important stuff? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with UW-Madison journalism professor Mike Wagner, talking about viral political slogans. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about the state of our political discourse, our conversation about politics? What ideas or solutions do you have for improving it? Do you think social media has made things better, worse, or just different when it comes to the way we communicate about politics? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. You know, I studied journalism when I was in college. I didn't get that as a degree, but we called it American Studies. And so I've always had an ear to the rail about, you know, politics in our country. And I want to ask the professor why it seems to me that the mainstream media is ignoring the right wing, which says that the, you know, the Democrats hold both houses of Congress and the White House. So they're saying that their agenda is communism and socialism. In other words, forced mandates. They're going to take away the Second Amendment rights, the First Amendment right to free speech. They're closing churches, you know, instead of, you know, bars and restaurants during a pandemic. Why doesn't the mainstream media address the accusation that communists and socialists are in power in Washington?
Jeff, thanks for the call. I mean, we see those claims, I think, from conservatives. Do you think, Mike, the media doesn't give it a fair hearing?
I would actually say that the news media is more willing to just broadcast some of those accusations without thoughtful engagement with whether they're true or not. We see lots of coverage in the news where we'll see a soundbite from a political leader claiming that the president is a communist, or that Big Bird is a communist, or that Nancy Pelosi is a socialist. And those things are not true. And so one thing news organizations can do is combat false statements with the verifiable truth. But it's also a danger for journalists to uncritically service stenographers in some cases, in national politics especially, where claims made by opponents of people in power are repeated without thoughtful questioning of whether or not the claims are true. And so no one has lost their speech rights in the Biden administration. The Biden administration has not signed a bill or done anything close to that that would restrict people's rights to own a gun. And so claims that those things have happened should not be amplified, because they haven't happened.
It's going out of Sherry in Elkhorn at 800-642-1234. Sherry, hi.
Hi. I just think we ought to turn it around and, like, do a positive spin on it. I don't care what you call me, Brandon or Biden, but let's go.
Sherry, thanks a lot for that call. And there's the thank you, Brandon, that I mentioned earlier. Mike, as other sides try to take each other's slogans and twist them to their own benefit.
That is, that insight from the caller is something that a lot of politicians try to do. And often when they do it, it takes some of the power away from the slogan or meme or thing that's getting attention. President Obama famously did that by, you know, saying people want to call the Affordable Care Act Obamacare, and like that's some kind of attack. And the president would say, I think that sounds nice. Obama cares. I'm all for calling it Obamacare. You know, so those sorts of things some strategic politicians will try to take that ammunition and turn it back around and turn it into something positive, just as the caller was talking about. And so there are lots of examples of that throughout American history and in American politics. Some more successful than others, but it's often a strategy that can diffuse the effort to attack.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking about political messaging and political memes, how they spread, how they go viral, with Mike Wagner from the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Mike, do you see one party or the other, or one politician or another, being particularly good or effective at capturing a simple meme, a simple idea or phrase, and making it stick?
I think that former President Trump had a great skill at that. He was very good. Long before he ran for president, he was a very avid user of Twitter and a regular guest on various kinds of television talk shows. And so he regularly had chances to kind of workshop ideas and test what sorts of things get more engagement and get more positive associations with them. And then there are literally examples of him on the campaign trail in 2016, and then throughout his presidency and his run, unsuccessful bid for re-election, where he would be in crowds and literally just tell the audience he's testing different lines to see which ones they like better. And he had a pretty strong and acute sense, I think, for what sorts of phrases his core audience would respond to. And he was very good at deploying those. He also, I think, had a strong sense for what kinds of phrases would generate extra media attention, which was also something that I think he was is uniquely good at.
How can we in the media be careful about giving that, I think marketing people call it, earned media that the source didn't pay for in advertising, and just caving in to effective messages like that?
That's a great question. I think that reporters and editors and news directors should be asking themselves, what's the news value of the slogan? Is it a one-day story where a reporter mishears something and it's kind of a funny story, like the origin of Let's Go Brandon, and so we cover it once or twice? Or maybe we cover the original genesis of the story and then note, oh, now some people are using it as a slogan, and then that might be one story. But to cover it over and over and over is kind of buying into something that really doesn't tell us what kind of job is President Biden doing. What are the ideas of his opponents? These are things we don't learn from extended coverage of a slogan. And so there's only so much airtime, there's only so many column inches, there's only so long people will spend online reading or watching information. And so if we're choosing to fill it with this and not other things, then we can't learn about the other things.
How much does the media not matter in how these kind of things spread with social media, and you're on this group on Facebook or you follow this person, you're way less likely to do this person on Twitter? How much is the media out of loop in the spread of these kind of ideas?
I would say that a lot of things that get their start on social media might not need traditional media to circulate widely for a short period of time. But to sustain it, traditional media is required. If any kind of meme or slogan or phrase or movement is to be sustained, there needs to be a kind of a symbiotic relationship between the churn of sharing that information on social media and the attention it gets from mainstream and also from more ideologically or advocacy-oriented news outlets. It's really an interaction between those things that keep these kinds of stories alive.
And staying on social media, Mike, there's a lot of focus, especially on Facebook and the platforms it owns, on how information and especially misinformation can spread on these platforms. What are you watching for as these companies make internal efforts, as Congress thinks about external efforts to try to change the way information flows?
I think some things to watch for are, do social media companies use their terms of service consistently? Do they apply them equally to different kinds of actors and different kinds of misinformation? Or is it idiosyncratic, haphazard? Do some people keep getting chance after chance while other people get removed from the platform? I think that's one thing to look for. Another thing to look for is what sorts of things on Twitter are trending, what sorts of things on Facebook are in that kind of top five engagements that you can see that are coming up on Facebook in any given day. And it gives you a sense of what the algorithm is privileging and what sorts of messages, what sorts of conversations are being shared the most widely. And we've seen on Facebook, for example, often kind of the top five engaged with posts come from folks on the right or the far right. And in recent weeks, that seems to have changed. It's possible that Facebook is changing what they privilege in their algorithm. And so watching for those things I think, smart ways for those of us who use social media to understand what we're coming in contact with because we're out there looking for what our friends are up to versus what we're coming in contact with and being exposed to because the algorithm is privileging some misinformation or information over other information.
Can you leave us, Mike, in our last half a minute or so with advice for that social media user on their phone or computer or whatever to make sure they're getting good quality stuff?
If it sounds really good for your side and really bad for the other side, find a second source. People really love to believe things that make them feel good and the other side feel bad. It's a natural human inclination. find someone else who says it too before you're too quick to endorse it. Think before you share, and see if you can't maybe expose yourself to a source that you normally wouldn't, just to see what else is out there.
Mike, thanks for joining us again today.
My pleasure.
That's Mike Wagner. He joined us for a look at what makes political memes and slogans go viral. Mike's a professor in the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Coming up, after another major poll was off significantly, we'll explore whether it's time to do away with election polls. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.